I woke up in the midnight, I saw the whole world on fire. Asia on fire, America on fire, United Nations on fire.
Hello and welcome when I woke up in this new podcast of the American Journal of Public Health. And this is a very special one because we have the great honor to have with us the 20th U.S. Surgeon General, Dr. Jerome Adams, who just published a book about his experience, and we wanted to have a conversation with him. I'm hosting this podcast with my great friend, associate editor, Professor Vicky Mays. Dr. Adams, hello. You have such an incredible CV. You're an anesthesiologist. You've been Surgeon General. You're a professor. You're a public health professional. How do you introduce yourself these days when you meet someone?
Well, you know, what's interesting is my Twitter profile says it all. Doctor, dad, and public health advocate. And so that's really when I'm talking to people, I talk about my kids. I've got three teenagers. I was the first Surgeon General in modern times to have school-age kids. And that greatly impacted a lot of what I chose to prioritize and also impacted the way I had to navigate and think about the pandemic. You know, I'm in a room with 60, 70-year-old people in many cases who don't understand what it's like to have three kids at home fighting over Wi-Fi during the midst of a pandemic. You know, these are real issues. But I'm very proud to be a physician. I still practice. And I also was the only Surgeon General, as far as I know, in modern times who continued to practice medicine while I was Surgeon General. I would do shifts at Walter Reed Medical Center. That impacted the way I approached the pandemic because I was literally elbow to elbow with physicians who were trying to figure out, okay, do we have enough PPE? What type of PPE do we utilize? Are we putting ourselves at risk by doing these elective procedures? But I mentioned public health advocate, and I'm very proud to be just the second Surgeon General. The other one is Dr. Jocelyn Elders, to have actually run a state public health department prior to becoming Surgeon General. And that was incredibly important because a point I make in the book is that while people looked to the Surgeon General and thought that I had had this magic wand I could wave to make all these things happen, most of the authority for public health lies at the state level in this country. Constitutionally and from a regulatory standpoint, when I was state health commissioner, I had more power, more authority, more funding than I did when I was Surgeon General of the United States. And my relationship with my fellow state health commissioners really helped me navigate the pandemic in a way that I think was unique.
And Dr. Adam, I think this translates very well in your book. I mean, you make this point extremely well. And before we start, let me tell you what I thought about the book. I love that book. I have to say, for many reasons. First of all, we hear you. And keeping your own voice in the book, you know, as soon as we start, you're talking to our ear. There's a almost direct relationship that is created. And we hear you and we go through the book. And I couldn't stop. I went from one page to the end. And it's a short book. So that was one reason. The second is that we learned a lot about you, a lot about your family, about yourself, about your life. But it's not only about you. I mean, and you are not on the first level. It's a book about being a U.S. Surgeon General. And on one side, you demystify the position. You know, we imagine Surgeon General being, you know, his own man or woman in his mansion in D.C., always in the White House, telling the president what to do, etc. And you show that this is not the case. But on the other hand, you also exalt or dignify the position. We understand that it takes to be a great personality to be a U.S. Surgeon General like you were. And so this all together makes it an incredible testimony. I would say, you know, it's an ethnographic study about being a U.S. Surgeon General. I really want to congratulate you for having, you know, produced such an interesting book, reading, and helpful also for everybody in public health.
Well, thank you. I tell folks it was a little bit of PTSD writing it. True story. We blocked out a lot of what happened over the last several years. We moved past it. We tried to forget about it. And going through the book, you know, there were many moments where I was like, oh, yeah, that did happen. Oh, my goodness. You know, we forget that in 2020, we didn't know whether we could bring our groceries or our mail in to the house. And everyone wants to look back in hindsight and say, well, you should have done X, Y, and Z. There was so much uncertainty and so many extreme things that we did, both from a government point of view and as individuals back then because of the uncertainty. So a little bit of PTSD, a little bit of therapy. I'm really helping people understand what I went through. I tell folks the book is part memoir, but it's also part lessons learned.
But so, Dr. Adams, tell us what was your fondest memory of the visit and what it was the worst?
Well, in the book, I talk about lots of people who I had the privilege of getting to meet and know when I was Surgeon General. That's one of the cool things about the job. I was mentored by Colin Powell. I got a phone call from Oprah Winfrey, which I talk about in the book. And that was at one of my lowest moments in truly in my life that Oprah called me and I was ready to quit. And, you know, and I tell a story in the book about how she convinced me not to quit. But the coolest story that I think personally I have was getting to meet Bill Clinton. I was at the Prescription Opioid Summit in Atlanta, and Bill Clinton and I were speaking one behind the other. So we were both backstage. The funny thing about this is his people didn't want me anywhere near him because I was Trump's Surgeon General. And my people didn't want me anywhere near him because he was Bill Clinton. It was just bad political PR for both of us. But we both are natural social people. And we started talking about our daughters. He talked about Chelsea. I talked about my daughter. And I had this picture still on my phone today where my daughter, funny story, when you go to the White House, once you get on the grounds, if you're an 8-year-old girl, you can go anywhere you want. And my daughter would run all over the White House. And I have this picture of her sitting on this couch in the White House underneath Bill Clinton's official portrait. And she's sitting there like laid out on this sofa. And I showed Bill Clinton this picture of my daughter underneath his official portrait in the White House. And we're cracking up, bonding over our daughters, you know, in their times dealing with dads who were in these incredibly high profile, invisible positions. And the point I make in telling you that story is that even amongst two people who politically would seem far apart, we were able to bond over being dads.
And so what was the worst then?
I will tell you the worst moment in the book was the moment when Oprah had to call and talk me off of a ledge during the midst of the pandemic, when I had really tried to raise the alarm about how people of color were at higher risk of negative outcomes from COVID-19. And this was something that the NAACP had asked me to actually help them raise awareness of. And so I used a press conference standing next to the president of the United States to talk about how people of color were disproportionately likely to be harmed by COVID-19 because of higher risk of comorbidities, because of their social circumstances. In many cases, they have frontline jobs, didn't have the ability to avoid COVID. And I said, and here are the steps that you should take to help keep yourself safe. But because I was standing next to Donald Trump, the media portrayed this as Donald Trump's Surgeon General blames Black people for getting COVID, which was not at all what I said. But I got attacked. I got attacked for literally trying to help communities of color understand their risk and understand how to protect themselves. I said, well, gosh, if I can't even talk about these issues without being attacked, if I can't represent the people who I feel most need help, then what's the point in me being here? And Oprah called me up. She explained to me that people who are hurting will often lash out and try to hurt other people. They attacked me not because of anything that I said or did personally, but because many people understandably were upset with Donald Trump and they saw me as an extension of Donald Trump. And they were scared and they were confused. And Oprah said, don't be so conceited as to think that this is about you personally. You need to stay in this role and continue to do the best that you can, because that's what God would want you to do. I still get emotional about that because it was a low time, but it was also my phone's ringing and it's no caller ID, and I pick it up. And I don't know why I picked it up, because it was media calling me left and right because of this firestorm. And I pick it up and it's Oprah Winfrey. And I went from the lowest of the low to the highest of the high by the end of that conversation. So that was both a low moment and a high moment.
That's great. So Vicky, do you remember those days?
I remember Dr. Adams very well during those days, and kind of in the background, you know, the one thing that I would say about his book that is so well illustrated by him is he's the people's doctor. So while he may have been feeling very alone, there are many of us in the background that had to tell people to get them straight about how supportive he was being. So that's one of the things I want to ask you about. Some days I have a sense that being the Surgeon General is such a high because you can see things happen, but being the Surgeon General as the people's doctor and the people feel like, but you're not there for me. What's mm-hmm. the experience like?
It's lonely. It really is incredibly lonely and frustrating. I tell folks the hardest part about being Surgeon General was that everybody wants you to make their number one priority your number one priority. So on any given day, I'm talking with sickle cell advocates. I'm talking with people whose family members died from opioid overdoses. I'm talking with people who want me to raise up cardiovascular disease or who want me to highlight maternal mortality. And it's very hard to try to be all things for all people. Now, the way I approached it, I really try to look at health equity and social drivers, social determinants of health, and to say, okay, how does creating healthier communities where people can make healthy choices actually help us lower cardiovascular disease? How does it help us lower cancer rates? How does it help us improve COVID outcomes? And so I think that's what you have to do is say, how do I figure out a way to navigate this world where everyone wants me to be their number one advocate, and there's just not enough time or enough bandwidth for you to really do a deep dive and be the biggest cheerleader for every single issue?
I just want you to know that some days it may feel lonely, but realize that because you really were viewed by many as the people's doctor, that you had a lot of support out there. So, you know, I'm glad Oprah called you, and that, you know, one of us didn't know to call you. So I'm glad she did, because we would have been devastated had we lost you, because that's, to me, the essence of the book is you are such a good illustration of the people's doctor, because you've been with the people, you mm-hmm. understand the issues, and you're committed to the people, not to the job, not to the politics, but really, that's why I would assume that, you know, you could have those feelings, because you were trying to help the people. So I have to say congratulations, because I think what your book really does is sends, you know, a message about the pathway to being, you know, in a political position, but really being a public health advocate.
Well, thank you for that. And Alfredo started off talking about my personal stories in the book. The reason why I share those is because that's really, I think, how and why I was a representative of the people. I talk about growing up with asthma, and I've carried an inhaler around in my pocket for 45 years of my life. So I knew what it was like to be a vulnerable person during the midst of a pandemic. I talk about how my mother had a stroke in 2020 and how my wife was diagnosed with metastatic melanoma. Both of them were not able to get treatment. So I very much knew the challenges of hospital shutdowns, even while as a practicing physician, I knew how important it was that we saved PPE for the folks who were taking care of the sickest patients in the ICU. You know, there's a saying that gets passed along through families. A car has a bigger front windshield than rearview mirror for a reason. And I think one of the challenges right now is that we spend most of our time looking backwards and pointing fingers, looking through that rearview mirror, instead of trying to figure out how do we move forward in a productive way. And it's why the car continues to veer off the road and hit trees over and over and over again with each new surge, because we're not learning those lessons. And that's really what I want people to take from the book.
But I have a question on this. You know, it's something that I don't have the answer myself, but I really would like to have your perspective, because in the book, you speak a lot about the polarization, the politicization of public health, the fact that this was an obstacle for being as effective as we could have been.
Absolutely.
But when you look at vaccination among people 65 years or more, almost every person in that age category in the country has been fully vaccinated. Red state, blue state, there seem to have been no discussion that they had to be vaccinated and the job has been done. How do you explain this? That even in states that are vituperating against the Surgeon General, against Fauci, et cetera, they did the job and they didn't discuss it.
So it's fascinating. And I think we need to really do a deep dive and understand a lot of aspects about vaccination that we don't have time to cover here. I think number one, you've got vaccine resistant people. Some people call them anti-vaxxers, but they're actually the minority. There are a lot of people who are vaccine hesitant or who have barriers to getting vaccinated. And I think one of the big dangers that we have, and I talk about this in the book, is when we portray everyone who was unvaccinated as being anti-vax. When we do that, we demonize them, we push them away, we push them into the arms of folks who really do have alternate agendas, and we actually give more voice to that vaccine-resistant or anti-vax movement. And you bring up a great point. The end of 2020, beginning of 2021, there was no anti-vax sentiment. People were fighting over who would have access to the vaccines. And that flipped for a number of reasons, and the politicization on all sides of the vaccinations, I think, really harmed us. And there's no mistake about it. There are a lot of Republicans who have taken on that mantle of being resistant to vaccines or questioning vaccines. But I also think calling it a pandemic of the unvaccinated was a mistake by the Biden administration. I'm an African-American. A lot of the Black community really had legitimate reasons to question the vaccines because of any number of things that have happened in the past. Henrietta Lacks, Tuskegee, we could go on and on. And to blame and shame people for having questions about vaccines, I don't think was appropriate. The vaccines were largely distributed in big settings, you know, at football stadiums, at health departments, et cetera. In those environments, people didn't have the opportunity to have a one-on-one conversation with their health provider about the vaccines. So just the very way we delivered those vaccines, I think, hurt the ability of patients who had questions to engage and get their questions answered. So you really had to decide before you even left the house, was I getting vaccinated or not? It wasn't like going to your doctor's office and being able to have that discussion. Now, I do think that in many ways it was a success when you point out the fact that we got most people over 65 vaccinated initially. But when you look at the most updated boosters, we're still less than 20%. Last I checked, and this was a few weeks ago, even in nursing homes and long-term care facilities, less than 25% of people are actually vaccinated in terms of having the updated vaccine. So in that sense, we went from a great success to what is an unmitigated failure at this point in time to protect the people who are most vulnerable.
But isn't this the normal for flu vaccine? I mean,
well, it's normal, but that doesn't mean it's right. And so every year, every Surgeon General comes out around October and says, get your flu vaccine. And so I tell people vaccine hesitancy is actually one of the biggest causes of health disparities in this country. People of color and people from disadvantaged and marginalized communities in many ways are being preyed upon by bad actors who are furthering their vaccine hesitancy. And when you look at the disparities in who dies from the flu, you know, it's people of color, people from marginalized communities who are disproportionately dying of the flu because they are under vaccinated. So you're right, we are drifting back to a normal, but we also have to understand that that normal wasn't acceptable. I don't ever want to go back to the way things were before 2020 for a lot of a lot of situations. You know, people say they want to go back to normal. Normal wasn't so great for a lot of us.
No, I agree. But it's different from saying that it's a failure or that it's the anti-vaxxer now are a majority in the population.
I agree with you. Yeah. We've got to make sure we're talking about vaccination both in positive ways and also in ways that point out the communities where we need to focus our attention.
There's a characteristic in your book, Jerome, is that each time you mention someone, you also mention their skin color. And that seems to be very important for you, and I can understand that. What's your reaction, Vicky? Is it different for you to have a Surgeon General that is an African-American or that has another skin color?
No, it's interesting because in doing that, there was, to me, a message that was there. And the message was part of the dynamics. And so what I would have to say is, yes, we have had Surgeon General, African-Americans, you know, we've had Latinas, et cetera. But part of the health, you know, quagmire that we find ourselves in really has to do with some of these other social determinants, to do with social risk and social vulnerability. And my sense, and I would love Dr. Adams to comment on this, my sense of calling out is painting the picture and recognizing the role that people's, you know, kind of their visual look, their emotions, their that's what comes into play in terms of everything from credibility to, you know, deciding you're not going to follow someone. So I thought that that was, to me, very interesting, and that what it did, excuse the pun, is kind of shade the emotion so that as you read it, you understood even better dynamics that were going on.
That was my personal story. And I wanted to be honest about how my race played into both the decisions that I made about what I was and wasn't going to prioritize, even my decision about whether or not to become the Surgeon General of the United States, to accept the role. And I talk about how my family, my wife, my friends discouraged me from taking the role of Surgeon General in what was seen as an administration that was hostile to African Americans. So even before I took the role, my race was being invoked as a reason for me not to participate. And what I explained in the book is I felt, conversely, that that was the reason why I had to participate. Because I can't tell you how many times I was the only at the table, the only African American, the only person who'd grown up in a rural community, the only person who had a chronic disease, the only person who was still a practicing physician. And so representation matters. It matters because of the viewpoints that you bring that may not otherwise be brought up if you're not there. It matters, and you mentioned this, Vicky, visually. We're at a time when fewer Black males are graduating from medical school than what there were 40 years ago. And so me being at that podium at the White House could be the reason why a little Black kid who's just walking by the TV believes that they could one day be a doctor, be a Surgeon General. That visual representation alone is incredibly important.
So Vicky, we're getting now at the end of this podcast. What's your take-home message from this interview?
For me, it's public health with a big P. You know, and it's interesting because I think sometimes the public doesn't see physicians as public health people. You see them as the deliverer of health care. But when you read the book and when you understand, this is another, I think, real contribution of the book is what a Surgeon General is and can be. That's why I said you're public health with a big P. We should give you a new middle initial, you know, because done is to illustrate despite the external context. Now, that's the difficulty that you have. But despite that context, what you did because of who you were and are is brought to the forefront a public health concern. And remember, it's been talked about these days that we're kind of losing this in terms of some of our major entities that are responsible for public health. So having a Surgeon General that despite a context of the medicalization of things really brought public health home, particularly during a pandemic. That's a message. So it's not that that little kid only decides that they want to be a physician, but they saw your name and they read the book at some point and see that physicians have had a long history of being public health advocates.
Exactly.
You brought that back into being a noble, acceptable activity. So my, you know, takeaway is what you brought is us back to the roots.
That means so much to me. And the book, actually, I'm donating a large portion of any profits I make to buying books to give to young people, because I want them to read it. I want them to have the opportunity to understand my journey, my experience. I mean, I grew up never believing I could be a doctor, a surgeon general, because I didn't know anyone who had ever done anything like that, who looked like me. So I want people to read the book for that reason. And I just really appreciate you saying that, because that is an important point from the pandemic. And so I hope people will read the book. I hope they'll understand that there's so much more than who was at 1600 Pennsylvania, or who was CDC director, or who was FDA commissioner, or who was surgeon general, that determines our outcomes. As a matter of fact, we had more people die in 2021 under a new administration than we did in an old administration. And that's not to say either administration was more or less at fault. It's to say that this premise that changing the captain of the Titanic was going to prevent us from hitting an iceberg in the future has been proven wrong. And so we need to figure out, okay, what more is happening and what more can we do to actually have a different outcome in the future? That's really what I hope people take from the book. And thank you all so much for the opportunity. I hope people do get a chance to read it. I hope they enjoy it. It's not too long, as Alfredo said. I wanted this to be fun and exciting and a good read that people leave and say, oh, I learned something that I didn't otherwise know beforehand.
Dr. Adam, usually I don't add anything after Vicky because I'm not as eloquent as her, as she is. But I want to say, yeah, the book should be read by everybody in public health. That's for sure. But also for people who are planning to reform the position, it should be a kind of blueprint, you know, again, an ethnographic investigation into the position. And you showed, as I said at the beginning, you kind of dignified the position and you showed that to be a U.S. Surgeon General like you, you need intelligence, you need courage, you need resilience, you need empathy, you need a lot of things that, you know, represent a great, great personality. And really thank you for what you've done for the nation.
Thank you. It's been an honor.
All right. So thank you for listening. This is the end of this podcast, and we'll see you soon again with my good friend and colleague, Vicky May. Bye-bye.
I woke up in the midnight, I saw the whole world on fire. Asia on fire. America on fire. United Nations on fire. When I woke up in